to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
Matthew chapter 14, but I need to show you these confusing names. Sometimes you read the name Herod in the Bible and you say, I don't know who that is. There's Herod the Great. He's the first one. He lived between 37 BCE and 4 BCE. So he never lived on this side of the timeline. Herod the Great, though, was the one who slaughtered the innocents. He was the great in his own mind. He was a horrible man, as so many were. And he was an Idumean from Edom, whose other name was Esau. So he was of cousins, if you will, of the Jewish people. That's where it would be geographically, but they weren't so geographically stuck in those days. They were tribally connected. His son was Herod Antipas, and he is the tetrarch we're going to see at the beginning of chapter 14 of Matthew. He was no good either. Tetrarch means the head of one-fourth, tetra, one-fourth of the kingdom that we call today Israel, but it extended much further because it was Roman. His son was Herod Agrippa, whom we see in the book of Acts chapter 12. He's the one who killed James. No, he's the one who killed James and had Peter arrested, put in prison. He was a no good Nick either. And his son was Agrippa the second, Herod Agrippa the second, who had Paul problem, Acts 25. So that's the who's who as we introduce Herod Antipas of Matthew chapter 14. Matthew 14, at that time Herod the Tetrarch heard the news about Yeshua and said to his servants, this is John the Baptist, he's risen from the dead, that's why miraculous powers are at work in him. Now that's a common theme, that's what people expect, because John was an enigma to Herod Antipas. He was a real problem. What had happened? Verse 3, when Herod had John arrested, he bound him and put him in prison because of the wife of his brother Philip, his sister-in-law, Herodias. You'd think they'd come up with other names, but they kept it all in the family. For John had been saying to Herod, it's not lawful for you to have her, meaning he had her, meaning he was committing adultery with his brother's wife. Mind you, that didn't go down badly in the Herod family. They had many wives and would randomly kill one and take another. That was their standard operating procedure. John had been saying it's not lawful. Verse 5, although Herod wanted to put him to death, he feared the crowd because they regarded John as a prophet. Fear is one of the two major considerations tonight as we look at reacting to the king. How do we react to Yeshua as king? When he rocks up and does all the things he does, what's our response? What will be the people's response as we talk to them out in the streets, or in their offices, or in their homes? What's your sister-in-law's view? What's your uncle's view? What's your cousin in Singapore's view of Yeshua? And how do they frame it? And how today can we help them react better to him? Herod was a man who had what's called the fear of man. He feared the crowd because they regarded John as a prophet. Now, if John's a prophet and you go messing around with their prophet, the crowd might come after you. So he's thinking, well, I better assuage everything, make sure everything's calm. But when his birthday came in verse 6, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod. So Philip and Herodias had this daughter. It might have been when Herodias changed her name to be Mrs. Herod. We don't know. So yeah, these players are all dark and dirty, you know. And it's a party. It's a birthday party. Pharaoh's the same. Caesar's the same. President is the same. Prime Minister's the same. It's titular. And you would take the title as opposed to take a new name. So they would add a second name. Herod Antipas. Herod Agrippa. Herod President Trump. President Kennedy. So this is one of the reasons why JWs don't have birthday parties, because look what happened. They don't celebrate birthdays. So whatever this dance was, it pleased Herod. So we don't know what kind of dance it was. I think it would probably have been sexual. Could have been belly. It could have been other body parts. It pleased Herod so much that he made a promise with an oath to give her whatever she asked. Sweetheart, that was a gorgeous dance. What do you want, honey? Having been prompted by her mother, she said, well, I'd really like John the Baptist dead. Can you put his head on a platter? Now that's just gross and gory. Mind you, John's in prison, but he's in prison because Herod can't figure out what to do with him. He fears the people, so he doesn't want to kill him. He doesn't want to release him because he's actually afraid personally of John. I don't know what to do. I'll just stick him in a prison. So the mother, Herodias, tells the daughter, we can get rid of that guy. Why does she want to get rid of him? Yeah, about her. Give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist. Verse 9, although he was grieved, really upset him, Lupeo. The king commanded it to be given because of two things. What are the two things? In other words, he swore to the daughter of Herodias, whatever you want, sweetheart, I'll give it to you. So he made an oath, which had to have been public, or else he could have negotiated on it. And because of his dinner guest. What's that called? It's the fear of man. He is so afraid of people that now the dinner guests override the people outside the palace. What had he said about the people outside the palace? About John. They regarded John as a prophet, so no way is he going to kill John to those people. But now he's embarrassed. He's promised anything. He wrote a blank check to this, how old was she? We don't know. And now the dinner guests overheard it. So for his reputation, that's the fear of people. The regard of people more than the regard of God. Fear of man will kill you. The fear of man will cripple your witness. Let's look at a few Bible verses. Proverbs 29, verse 25. The clear comparison is fearing God or fearing people. Now, it's not that we're afraid of people in a cowering sense, but rather that we are moved by whatever they say or whatever they think. Isaiah 51, verse 7. So if you know God, in whose heart the law of God, you care what people think. What does it matter what people think? We really have to have a either God or people orientation. And here Herod Antipas is clearly worried about reputation. He's worried about his own name, and therefore not worried about the honor and name of God, which is why he's able to kill the prophet of God. Galatians 1:10. There you go. There's the either or that the Apostle Paul makes clear. If I want to seek the favor of men, that's the fear of men, then I won't be fearing God. You can have one or the other. Or am I striving to please men? If I were still trying to please men, which obviously is something he did in his past, I would not be a bondservant of Messiah. James 4, verse 4. Now this describes Herod Antipas to a T. He wanted the approval of people. And if I sought the approval of people, I'd get it. But I wouldn't be a friend of God. That's what he's saying. That's what James says. That's what Paul writes to the Galatians. That's what Antipas demonstrated in his own behavior. And he killed John the Baptizer. How horrible is that? The most noble prophet from the Old Testament, period, ever. A brilliant guy who was the forerunner of Messiah. So that's fear of man. It brings a snare. It will ruin you. You will ever be trying to get people's approval. You get that, you can get it. If that's what you want. Back to Matthew 14. Verse 10, he sent and had John beheaded in the prison. He didn't even have it down there because he wanted to bring it on a platter. So there it is, verse 11. His head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. So who's really the generous one, and who's really the boss in this picture? So Herod brings it to the girl brings it to mom, and mom's obviously the end of the food chain there. So that's a horrible end to the Baptist. Horrible end. And what would you do if your cousin, John, is just killed in a horrible way? Look what happened. The disciples came, took away the body and buried him, and went and reported to Yeshua. They gave him an honorable... Well, they'd probably not have the head. We don't know. Oh, well, they've changed that, what with wars. You know, destruction of people's bodies. Suicide used to be you can't go to heaven if committed suicide. And what? And marrying a Gentile. So all kinds of things. When Yeshua, verse 13, heard, he withdrew from there. We're going to see that over and over in chapter 14, 15. So we're going to see him withdrawing again and again. He is counting down his own death. And he's now in a place where he knows the clock is ticking. He's been out there marvelously healing, gathering big crowds, preaching, getting some kickback, getting some fulfillment. But now he knows, with John dead, I'm next. He knows. He went from there in a boat to a secluded place by himself. I think King James said to a lonely place. And when the people heard of this, they followed him on foot from the cities. I'll leave the guy alone. He's trying to get away. He's trying to have some prayer time. But what does he do? He saw the large crowd, and he felt rahmanis for them. Real compassion. And he healed their sick. He took care of people. Even when he desperately needed time off, he looked and said, I'll subjugate my own needs for theirs just now. What a savior. What a hero. It's great. So he deals with people's problems. He heals them. And now it's approaching evening. Think of a long, maybe summer evening. The disciples came and said, this place is desolate. The hour's already late. Don't think midnight. Just think it's sometime into the evening. So let's send the crowds away that they can go into the villages and buy food for themselves. Because if it's midnight, there's no stores open, right? So it's late afternoon. And Yeshua is hearing, you know, the disciples saying, hey, let's get rid of these people. Yeshua had compassion on them. He's the one grieving. The disciples should have been grieving. They should have been buffering Yeshua away from the needs of the people by taking care of them, not by dismissing them. Yeshua said, no, they don't need to go away. You give them something to eat. They said, excuse me, we only have 5 bagels and a couple pieces of lox. You know, we don't have, this is not going to work out. He said, bring them here to me. And he ordered the people to sit down on the grass. I like that. So if you're standing, you don't get any food. Sit down. In the presence of the king, you may be seated. He is the exalted. Pretty cool. He took the 5 loaves, 2 fish, looking up toward heaven, blessed and broke the loaves. And he gave the disciples and they distributed. That's the way they're supposed to do it. That's the way you and I are supposed to do it. We're supposed to be distributors, not manufacturers. We're supposed to give out what God's given us. They all ate. They were all satisfied. And they picked up all the broken pieces, 12 full baskets. They started with how many loaves? 5 loaves and then with 12 full baskets. These are giant baskets. These aren't little lunch boxes that you know, with Superman on the front. This is substantial. I just think this is remarkable. What do we learn from that? That we should clean up after ourselves. We learn that God's provision is always abundant, exceedingly abundantly beyond what we ask for. There were about 5,000 men who ate, besides the women and the children. So he's fed 5,000 people with a couple guys' lunch. Now, some people say, when Yeshua got this from Andrew and the little boy's lunch, and then he passed it around, everybody became generous. They all had their lunch, and they learned to share. But no, because in the Gospels, and by the way, this is one of only a few miracles that are in every Gospel. All 4 Gospels have the feeding of the 5,000. And one of them says, this was a sign, and they wanted to make him, well, look what it says. He made the disciples get in the boat, verse 22, go ahead of him to the other side. Well, he sent the crowds away. Why did he do that? Because they wanted to make him king. He said, no, that's not the way it's going to work. Lunch doesn't create kingdom stuff. But why would they want to make him king if it was just that he inspired them to share their lunch? No, this was a miracle of reproduction, of a little bit giving a lot of bit to a lot of people. 5,000 men who were seated, and then all the women and all the kids. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of lunch. It is a miracle. And why is it in all 4? It's just one of those, I want to say, seminal miracles that you don't want to miss. It is too big so that every gospel writer includes it. Why do they do that? Because God wants to. This wasn't just an ordinary, well, maybe he wasn't as sick as they said that paralytic was. Maybe that blind guy really could see. But here are at least 7,000 to 10,000 people who are getting a massive meal, 12 baskets full picked up. Nobody had to go into villages. That's a lot of testimony of the reality of the miracles of Yeshua. And one of those things that I think we ought to keep highlighting to people when we're witnessing to them. Well, what do you know about Yeshua? Well, I don't know. A big teacher. Yeah, do you know he did miracles? Yeah, I've heard about that. Which ones have you heard about? He's going to do 2 in tonight's episode. 2 big ones. Misses 1. The king reacted in pain at the death of his cousin. The crowd then assembles and the crowd eats. They're reacting to the king. Everybody's kind of got their impression. Herod, I'm not so sure. I don't know who this, you know, he's dismissed Yeshua. His father killed the innocent children. Bad family. Now the crowd has a relationship with him that is particularly personal. It's particularly culinary. It's particularly self-indulgent. I'm going to go to him, he'll heal us. I'm going to go to him, he'll feed us. Okay, that's okay. It's better than rejecting him. Verse 22, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side while he sent the crowds away. That's a funny picture. Doesn't that surprise you? Wouldn't you think some of the boys would say, now, you fellas go over to that village. You get everybody go home. Yeshua needs some time. But he sent them away across the Sea of Galilee. And he said, I'll take care of them. I wonder what they were thinking. Look what verse 23. He sent the crowds away and he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. He's going to do this regularly through the gospel. And when it was evening, he was there alone. Meaning it was late evening. Later that same night, he's there alone. What's he doing? He's getting renewed. His sponge was empty. He'd been drained. He cried. I'm guessing he cried, don't you imagine? When his cousin died, with slaughter, with some violence. I can just feel that grief. I hope you can too. And Yeshua goes up to the mountain and he's pierced. And he's really hurt. And he talks to his father. And he gets comforted. Remember, Yeshua is the one who said, blessed are those who mourn. They shall be comforted. And he knew how to get that comfort. Not from the boys. Not from the birthday party. But he got it from his father. We need that too, don't we?
Amen.
We really need that time with the Father all by ourselves. I love that at my house. It's really quiet in the morning, especially since all my children have moved out. But it's really quiet. And I can be with God. I go into my little space and sit on my little chair and read my little book and talk to God. And it's like a shrine, I suppose. It's therapy. I don't know. It's all those things. It's definitely health-bringing to reconnect with Him. First thing in the day, He likes to hear from us, I think. I sure like hearing from Him. So that's what Yeshua is doing. He's getting his sponge full again. The boat was already a long distance from the land. I think it's a stadion. Isn't that the word? Yeah, it's the Greek word, which is a particular distance. Battered by the waves and the wind was contrary. They are having a tough time. Now, some of them are fishermen. Fishermen who are used to being out on this boat. Who are used to being on the boat at night. Because that's when you fish. But this was unusual. This was a bigger than normal storm. You know any other guys in the Bible who went through a storm like this? Noah's in a boat for 40 days, 40 nights. And it turned out... He's in that boat for 360 days because it took a long time for the water to recede. Yeah, so he understands tossing and turning on a boat and confidence in the God who told him to build that. Jonah's in there because of judgment. The disciples are there not for judgment, but for growth. Sometimes we go through storms for one reason or another. You can't dismiss them and say, well, God doesn't want anybody to go through storm. I watched a really bad movie yesterday. It was on Foxtel. It came on after a fun movie that I was watching. And I must have fallen asleep, go figure. And I woke up to a really bad movie. It was a cartoon. And it was filled with bad language and bad attitudes. And it was a stupid premise. I didn't even like it. But I watched for about, I don't know, 10 more minutes. And it was interesting. It was all kind of peachy keen. Everything was happy. They were singing songs as they do in cartoons. And then a bad guy was introduced. Without the introduction of a bad guy, stories, they're not good. You got to have a bad guy in a story. I mean, what kind of story would it be if you read a story here in our bookcase and so-and-so was born here in Vienna and used to eat Wiener Schnitzel and had a nice time at the schoolyard. Nobody ever beat him up. He went to synagogue. He read his Bible. He found out Yeshua was the Messiah. Everybody was happy for him. He died. We all live happily ever after. What kind of boring story is that? You got to have conflict. You got to have opposition. You got to have the evil cartoon character in the black cape. And how do we grow? But by meeting that opposition, by meeting that Darth Vader character, and whether we find out he's our father, or we find out there's some way to overcome him. When that happens, we become better people by overcoming the evil that's there. That's real. And I got that, by the way, from a book by Peter Kreft in 1985 called Making Sense Out of Suffering by Peter Kreft. And some of his arguments in that book are so brilliant. He's a C.S. Lewis devotee and a fantastic writer. I really like his style. And in the book, he argues that without evil, without suffering, without troubles, your life is boring. Your life doesn't work. Your life needs that for you to overcome, to become a better person, grow in life. So it makes sense. Well, judgment isn't condemnation. Judgment is corrective. So when Jonah's in that boat, and then they toss him overboard, and the whale eats him, and then he's spat out by the whale, in a wonderful hurl. When that happens, then he hears the word of God again and turns and goes and preaches to the Ninevites. So it was a corrective, which is biblically judgment, not condemnation. Storms have their purposes. And those who believe that life should all be smooth sailing, if I can use that phrase, they don't get it. Well, this takes place in verse 25. In the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. What time's the fourth watch? 3 to 6 a.m. The first watch is 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Second, 9 p.m. to midnight. Third, midnight to 3. Fourth, 3 to 6, approximately. So it's 3 in the morning and Yeshua is walking on the water. It's 4 in the morning. What the heck would be your thought? You're there in the boat, this small craft. You're a fisherman. You're used to this. Matthew's not. Simon the Zealot is not used to this. But, you know, the guys like Peter, yeah, we got this under control. By then, they are not in control. And everybody should be flipping out. The disciples saw him walking on the sea, and they were terrified and said, "It's a ghost." And they cried out in fear. See, the reaction, the natural reaction, is the same as Herod Antipas had, fear. Until they meet him. They thought it is a spirit or a ghost. The Greek word, a phantasm. You know, a fantasy, a ghost, a spirit, something from the other side. Yikes, what is this? Now, they've been hanging around with Yeshua for some time. He sent them across. They're in this ship, small craft. You'd think they'd say, "Hey, the Lord wouldn't leave us out here." They should think, "Oh, maybe that's the Lord." But when you're in turmoil, you don't always think right. So Yeshua said this in verse 27, "Take courage." I love that. Be confident. Be courageous. Take courage. If you were at my house and you hung up your coat, your house, sorry, you hung up your coat, and I say, "Hey, let's go outside. By the way, it's cold. You haven't been out yet today. You better take your coat." What would you do? You'd reach for it. You'd put it on. You'd go. Take courage says to me, courage is available. Courage is accessible. Courage is something that you can own and you can appropriate. It is not in heaven that you cannot get it. It's available to you. I love that about Yeshua. Take courage. It's right in the closet. It is I. See how he answers dilemmas of life? With his own presence. It's I. Don't be afraid. Fear not. 365 times in the Bible, phobia, fear, is told to us not to. Don't be afraid. 365 times. So every day of the year, take courage. Every day of the year, don't be afraid. There's always a reason not to be afraid. Plenty of reasons to be afraid. But what's the opposite of fear? Hope,
trust.
Confidence, trust, faith. It's all that. It's confidence and trust in the one. That's why he says, it's I. Focus on me, guys. That you're disoriented. I want you to be oriented in me. Peter said, "Lord, if it's you, like a king, Keleuo, command me to come to you on the water." This is a royal edict he's asking for. So Yeshua said, "Come." I love that. He doesn't say, "Well, if you feel led, Lord, if that's you, I want to be out there with you." This is so cool. Peter says, "I was afraid a minute ago, but it's you." And he turns his fear to faith. It's not just faith in this idea of faith. It's faith in the Messiah. He particularizes his faith. In the same way, he had particularized fear in the water, in the storm, in the darkness of night. He got out of the boat and walked on the water and came toward Yeshua, verse 29. What a great ending that would be, just right there. But what does he see? Yeah, he sees the wind. What had he seen before the wind? What got him out of the boat? He saw Yeshua. Well, yeah, but who walks on water? I mean, Yeshua heals people. I don't say, "Excuse me, I want to give that one a go. Dr. Bob here." You know, you don't do that. But for some reason, the miracle of walking on water is pretty cool. And Peter says, "I want to do that. I've been on this lake how many years fishing? I've never seen anybody walk on it. Come on. If that's you, let me get out there with you." He said, "Come." Peter got out of the boat and looked at Yeshua. And he walked towards Yeshua. But then the wind came up. And fear gripped him again, and beginning to sink, not when he was glub, but just at the beginning of his sinking, he cried out, "Lord, save me." And Yeshua didn't say, "You numbskull." I love that. He reached out and he said, "You of little faith." It is, because at the end of the day, faith is what Yeshua is looking for. Why did you edistasas. Why did you stand divided? Why did you doubt? Yeah, and it's a double-mindedness. It's a, I believed I was going with Yeshua, and then, but look at the water, look at the wind, look at the waves, look at, nature is pretty powerful. I've been out here. And so Yeshua says, why did you believe two things? End of 31. That standing divided is fear. Why did you stand? He stretched out his hand, took hold of him. We don't see that completely. They got into the boat. The wind stopped. And those who were in the boat worshipped and said, you're certain God's son. I don't know what just happened, but I was not convinced, but now I am convinced. We don't know if it's just the 12. We don't know who else is in the boat, but whoever was there said, you demand. It's morning. Verse 34, they came to land at Gennesaret. It's on the Sea of Galilee near Bethsaida. And the men of that place recognized him because he was fairly well known. Epigenosko, to know, to look upon, to witness, to recognize. They sent word into all that surrounding district and brought to him everyone who was sick. Doctors in town, Dr. Yeshua is here. He just got off a boat. He's wet. He just lost his cousin. It's a horrible day. He didn't get his private time complete with the Lord. And what happens? The crowd shows up. What does he do? They implored him that they might just touch his tzitzit, and as many as touched it were cured. So he's wearing something, maybe not a special prayer shawl, maybe just fringes on the end of his cloak. I think the modern prayer shawl is an add-on, because in Numbers 15 it says to put fringes on the corners of your garment. So it doesn't say, oh, by the way, have a separate garment. How many people had garments? How many garments did they have? These are slaves coming out of Egypt. You know, they only had one, maybe two. So the fringes were there. What do we have? We have the story of how people react to the king. People who live in fear of people and therefore don't fear God. We have people who assemble to him because he does tricks, miracles, and feeds them. And then we have others who are drawn to him and comply with his commands and who encounter him for real. The reacting to the king that he requires is faith. This is not news. We've seen this from the very beginning. Faith is not an abstract idea. It's not mental assent. It is comprehensive, complete devotion to the one who's got the whole world in his hand. And if I really do trust him, whether I'm on the water in a boat that's collapsing, or my hand is withered, or I'm starving after 3 days of walking there, and somebody says, I think he's going to feed us. Whatever he provides, I'm going to take it on board. And I just hope that we will live in that kind of comprehensive faith. Yeshua is going to ask, when he comes, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? End of the day, he's not looking for religious activity. End of the day, he's not looking for singing. Although you want to sing, that's fine. He's not looking for praying. Although if you want to pray, that's good. He's looking for you and him to be in relation. And that works by faith. I trust him for my life. I trust him for my wife. I trust him for my children and grandchild children. I trust him for this shop. I trust him for this ministry. I trust him for you guys and those who come and they're part of us. I trust him for the unbelievers in our life who are yet to say yes to him. We trust him. When he comes, will he find faith in me? Will he find faith in you? Not are we that great and devoted and religious, but do we trust him? That is Matthew 14.